It's just a weight off seeing actual customers in front of you. I remember that, yeah, when we reopened the first time, it's, you know, just lots of different stories, lots of, you know, how grateful customers are to be back into a restaurant situation and enjoying themselves. And it really makes you understand how vital sort of the restaurants and hospitality in general are for, you know, the common good.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep.
The indiscriminate nature of the pandemic meant ego, reputation, and influence meant nothing. It put everyone in the restaurant industry on a knife's edge. But the resilience of the industry as a whole has been incredibly inspiring. With Melbourne finally allowed to begin trading like other Australian cities, what does the future hold for the culinary capital of Australia? Frank Kimura is the owner of Mavita Restaurants, a group that changed dining not only in Melbourne, but Australia too. Frank, how are you?
Good, Anthony. How are you?
I'm good. You finally got a date set that you can open the doors and welcome people in. How did it feel when you got that news?
Well, I mean, it was almost a little bit surprising, to be honest, because, it wasn't, set in stone that we were going to be able to open before there were, zero cases. So we were hoping we were going to get a similar sort of result that the regional parts of Victoria did, and looks like we're going in that direction, which, makes us all feel like a lot more confident, especially, with these sort of numbers, or the COVID numbers that are here now. I feel more confident about opening and not fearing that we're going to be closed down again.
What sort of impact has this period of time had? It's been such a long time for Melbourne operators to deal with this sort of alternate reality. Has it taken a toll on you and the business?
I think it'd be silly to say it hasn't taken a toll out of everybody, I'd say, because I was actually speaking to the guys before. I'd almost lost track of how long we've been closed for, but it's been well over 100 days in this second closure, so over 3 months.
Wow.
Yeah, we opened for just under a month, and, there's obviously almost 2 months prior to that. So for the majority of this year, we were, we've been closed as far as our normal operations go, and we've had to sort of do things a little bit differently, but also, deal with frustrations from, staff, customers, suppliers, ourselves, and trying to make the best of a shit situation, basically.
What's it like at the moment trying to plan for a reopening? How are you feeling about getting all of the wheels in motion again?
It's still a little bit confusing, to be honest. So there's sort of still some mixed messages. There's no concrete rules that have come out from the state government. So we're still trying to sort of navigate that. But we're making assumptions that, we are going to be allowed to have 20 people inside. We are going to have some outside dining. And the beauty of that is that we have worked under those conditions before in the first opening. So we know already what works as far as how do we structure a roster, how do we structure a menu, how do we structure our reservations. So we're ready as far as that's concerned because we've had a bit of practice the first time around. But it's really whether there's going to be changes, when we reopen. I'm assuming we'll be wearing masks. Will the same density rules apply? What size tables are the maximum size tables? All that sort of stuff, all the finer details still to be sorted out.
What sort of version of Mavita and the restaurants that you have will we see in that sort of initial stage? Will it be quite different to what we're used to?
Mavita, I think we want to stick to our guns. There is rumours that there may not be shared food allowed, which seems kind of a bit strange to me, so a bit foreign, because when you really think about shared food, it's obviously tapas, but it's also pizza, it's also Chinese food, it's also Indian food, it's like every cuisine in the world except for Anglo and French food, really. Majority 90% of the restaurants in Melbourne have some form of shared eating, it's not just tapas. So So that's the one thing that we really need to sort of have worked out for us. But if hopefully shared food still allowed to happen, then I think we're going to do very much what we were doing before, and I think that's what customers expect. They want the same style. The only thing is the density restrictions really restrict the atmosphere of a restaurant, and I think that's kind of the essence of a place. I mean, when you go out for dining, it's obviously about the food, it's obviously about the service, but it's more than anything about an experience. And you know, and I think that experience is about the other customers, about the vibe of the place, the noise and the, you know, and the laughter. And I felt, you know, in that first opening that, yeah, the restaurants lacked that. There wasn't the atmosphere and the vibrancy of a normal Moveda experience.
During this time, what sort of initiatives did you put in place to get money coming through the door? Was the offering quite different to what you would normally have in the restaurant?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've gone through such a range of different things that we've been doing. So initially when the closures came, we decided to do a little bit of takeaway from Moveda next door and also operate that as a grocery store. So Moveda products and other business products. We import, you know, wine, we import food from Spain, plus obviously we have some amazing connections with suppliers. So we thought we'd set that up specifically so people could drop by and buy things, and also some ready-made meals ready to go. And it, you know, it bombed badly. And reason being is because the CBD just overnight just became a ghost town, so there was nobody there to buy the stuff. And my initial thoughts was maybe it's actually not worth doing takeaway. It was actually a staff that started sort of asking, you know, for something to do. A couple of weeks into just being fully closed, they started coming to me and going, look, we need something to do. Can we try doing some takeaway? So we came up with the concept, which was Menú del Día, which is the menu of the day. If anyone's been to Spain, like when you go to, you know, a little, a typical Spanish bar restaurant will have, you know, workers or white collar and blue collar style lunch that's really well priced. It's three courses. It's comfort food, but it's delicious and classic sort of Spanish dishes, and it's really inexpensive. And we thought that would be the sort of model maybe to produce for people to have at home. So we just thought we'd do, you know, things that are accessible price-wise, but also, you know, food-wise, and do it all ourselves, which meant, you know, producing the food, delivering the food. Our front-of-house guys are awesome. They were, you know, along with delivering food, they're also painting the restaurants and sanding back the bars and doing whatever was required. And then we opened up, so we stopped doing that. And then the second closure, which, you know, came as a massive surprise to everyone here, really, because we were really seeing, you know, some light at the end of the tunnel. You know, we were seeing, you know, the opportunity to open up for 50 people, and, you know, and we were making plans for that. And then all of a sudden, the rug got pulled out of us. And so we brought back the menu there. We also started doing comida corrida, which is a Mexican term for the same style of food. They have like a fast and accessible lunch menu. And that was to basically support our international chefs, which at that stage, you know, all of a sudden were getting shifts again, but got pulled out. So we thought we'd, chefs and front of house, we just allocate them that job and get their salary done for that, and that worked really well as well. And it was basically one of our young chefs who's Mexican background that was working as a sous chef in Lawn for us, and she ran that. And on top of that, we also started using a platform called Providor, which has been really successful and has been going really well. Food delivered but by a logistics company rather than us, and it's more like food that somebody has to finish off at home. So it's not completely cooked. It has, you know, several different components. Say, for instance, like a paella, it's got the rice, the stock, the sofrito, the seafood, and you make that together at home.
Were there challenges in putting together that sort of menu?
It was, because, you know, it's not something we're really... I guess as a chef, you don't really sort of consider ever how you would, you know, represent your food well in the home environment, because, I mean, we never ever would have considered doing Uber not only because the commissions are so high, but also how does that food translate carried by somebody to, you know, to their home where you don't have control of that? Yeah, it was come up with a new concept of, okay, how do we create the components that people can do it, you know, not too difficult, but get as close to the product that they would at the restaurant at home. So it took a bit of trial and error, even with the, say, for instance, the paella is all about, you know, finding a foolproof, idiot-proof recipe, which, you know, is not that easy. Look, I actually got a complaint, actually, with our beef cheeks the other day, which was quite funny, because, so we do a beef cheek with Pedro Jimenez reduction and cauliflower puree, and we sort of cook the beef cheeks overnight in PX in Pedro Jimenez, and we got a massive complaint. Four people said, oh, yeah, the beef cheeks were completely burnt. And I'm going, oh, it doesn't make zero sense, because they never see, like, open flame unless you've done it at home. They've been covered in liquid. So it's always going to be issues, but we try and make it as easy as we can, yeah.
You've also done collaborations. I know you did something a bit left field with Sandra from Picolina.
Yeah, so Sandra contacted us out of the blue and asked, you know, I buy her ice cream on Uber Eats plenty of times from for the kids and us at home. But, yeah, it just seemed like a good concept. So, I mean, she's amazing. Like, she's continuing to open restaurants. Well, not restaurants, but ice cream shops in the CBD currently. Like, she's fitting out two new places and has a third on the way, which, you know, is amazing positivity. I'm not sure if I'd be that keen to open new places right now, but yeah, she was great to work with. We sold like 500 boxes, so we'd do the savory. We collaborated on the ice creams, and yeah, it was really successful, which was good. Yeah.
How do you feel about the future of the industry at the moment, given the year that the Melbourne industry's just had?
Look, it's hard to know what is going to happen. I'm not 100% pessimistic and 100% optimistic. And, you know, my philosophy has always been is, you know, you can control what's directly in front of you and, you know, and make decisions that can influence that as best your ability can provide. So, you know, I'd love to have a crystal ball and know what's going to happen. But, I mean, looking back over the industry, so 2019, that was a tough year, I think, generally in restaurants in Melbourne. And, you know, I think my colleagues have all said it was a difficult year, and this certainly wasn't expected. 20 was expected to be difficult, but nothing like this. But with that, I mean, we're, like you said at the start, we are resilient. We do, you know, get on with it, whether it's in a service or within, you know, our businesses in general. And I think most of us are going to find ways to get through it. But I do fear, you know, there are going to be lots of different closures of restaurants, and there already have been. You know, people that operate amazing businesses that, you know, just through no fault of their own and the position everyone's in, are going to find it difficult. And I think the difficulty is not going to be necessarily this next few months, but I think next year, you know, as government subsidies decrease and are removed, and as people find the reality of their economic situation, I think that's when, you know, when restaurants will probably suffer a little bit more than they even have currently.
I don't think it's an understatement to say that you changed the conversation for Spanish cuisine in Australia. You were born in Barcelona and grew up in Australia. What's the similarities there? And, what, you know, tell us about Spanish cuisine from your perspective.
I guess, you know, for me, like, what we tried to translate from Spain to Australia seemed very natural. I guess, you know, what we created was the bar as the centerpiece and the core of a restaurant. So a bar and a comedor, which is a dining room, I guess that's essentially what a Spanish restaurant is. So if you know, if you think maybe like a classic French restaurant is a bistro, a classic Italian restaurant is a trattoria, for instance, that whole feeling of you can sit at the bar and eat and not feel like you just have to drink, or vice versa, I can have a drink and not eat. That flexibility, that sense of theatre, sense of vibrancy, a sense of flexibility, and the customer decides how they want to treat that space and how they want to use it, I think really translates well to Australia. And I think also the fact that the location that we're in the CBD of Melbourne was a big part of the success of Movida. Not only, the laneway feels like you might be in Barcelona, you might be walking down somewhere, in the Barrio Gótico, but the fact that, there's a theatre right next door, there's a Forum Theatre, there's a gallery across the road, there's Acme across the road from that, there's lots of residents, there's lots of offices, so it's a real mixed-use entertainment fun. It's a vibrant sort of city, and even the laneway itself, which is, it was one of the most visited locations in Australia, Hosier Lane, just for the graffiti. So, it felt right to have that style of restaurant where you could just pop in and pop out, and you could come in certainly and have, a long lunch or meet friends for a special dinner, but also you could just pop in for a glass of wine, a glass of sherry and a small tapper and then pop out and use it how you felt.
What was food like for you when you were a kid?
Awesome. Loved it. That's why I'm a chef, to be honest. So that really, grew up with, I came out here when I was five, and mum and dad always loved food. But I guess when they first came out here, they never really, they never knew how to make their own jamón, or they never knew how to cure their own ollies, or make chorizo, because they'd, have the access to that in Spain and just buy it at the shop. But here they, there was a small community. I actually grew up in Geelong, and one person might know how you make your chorizo, one person knew how to make olives. So every week we'd be doing something. We used to go out and get our own clams. We used to go and get velvet crabs. We used to go and catch snails. So I remember springtime rains. That was like, oh cool, let's go grab snails and collect them and bring them back home and purge them. And then we used to do one of my most favourite dishes. I still like probably my most favourite dish in the world. If you go to Cordoba, they have this, which is my hometown where my family's actually from, even though I was born in Barcelona. They have this dish which is snails, and it's in like this a broth, which is a mint and garlic broth. And you basically drink the broth and then you eat the snails, and they set up these little casetas all over the streets for about a 2-month period. Everyone goes in, it's like the... And we used to cook that, and so from a very early age I was eating snails and all sorts of weird, wonderful things. And I think, my background was originally, first migrant generation. Mum and dad obviously wanted to push my education, so I studied architecture for 5 years and eventually realised that wasn't really my calling. Basically, I was going to be a crap architect, and I was much better at that. And meanwhile, I was still cooking in all sorts of little restaurants around Geelong, and decided I wanted to do it professionally, but could only really do it well if I did an apprenticeship. So went back, took a few steps back, and and then worked for the Grossis for a long time, 8 years or so in Italian food, and then thought, well, yes, I can cook Italian food, but I thought that, there was a lot of chefs that could cook Italian food, and that's when I headed back home to Spain, and spent a year working over there and then traveling after that, and came back and we opened Movida.
You've been an incredible influence on so many, but what do you think has been the main influences in your life for your food?
For my food, I think people that I really looked up to as a young apprentice were Greg Maloof, Guy Grossi, people that sort of, maybe second generation migrant, but then took that food that they grew up with and then elevated it in some form, not only the food, but also the experience of dining in that cuisine. So for me, those two chefs, knew how to, use only the best ingredients, how to refine something just enough without losing the essence of that particular dish. Most important thing is, a great people as well, and, created great teams to work with. So I think that would, the influence for my career is people like that, because I think, for me, I think if you want to be a chef, it has to come from a sense of authenticity. And authenticity doesn't necessarily mean the the cuisine you grew up with, but it might be a style of food that you authentically really love and want to translate. It could be anything from barbecue, it could be vegan, whatever it is. But and I think that the chefs that have that and teach that to the apprentices, it's not about, for me, following what's the next fad, what YouTube video you've watched and what technique you've pinched out of that. It's basically, you know, where it comes from you, and that's how you create great food, I think.
Moving forward, you know, Mavita's had or renowned for certain signature dishes. You know, what sort of version are we going to see of Mavita moving forward? Will they reappear, or do you think that there'll be a new incarnation of Mavita moving forward?
There'll certainly be some of the signature dishes that we have. I think the anchovy with smoked tomato sorbet is sort of one of those dishes that it's pretty iconic for us, and I think we'd have a disaster if we took it off. But there's other dishes that I'm so over, like we won a dish in 2005 for the Good Food Guy for the best dish of the year, which is a wagyu cured with a potato foam and truffled egg. It's one of those dishes, yes, loved it the first 50 times I tried it, but about after the second or third 100th time, I can't stand eating it anymore. So I think that might be one that might come off. Although last time we did take it off because we'd ran out of the cured wagyu. I think it was a massive backlash. But I think people understand now more, like the menu is going to have to be limited. We can't, like we always have at every restaurant, you know, six or seven different specials dishes, which are just basically, you know, when we talk to the fishmonger, when we talk to our butcher, when we talk to our veg supplier, what they might have that's interesting and which play around there. But I think those things, when you're limited to 20 people and maybe 20 people outside, have to be sort of, you know, it's just keeping things a bit more constricted and refined. So, you know, things are fresh, basically, which is the most important thing.
Identity is a real thing in the industry, and you know, successful restaurants are down to the identity of the individuals behind them. What's Mavita done for you? Has it changed your life, or has it just been a natural evolution of what you believed in?
It's certainly changed my life. I mean, it's allowed me to do a lot of things that I would never have thought, you know, were possible. You know, being able to spend 2 months in Barcelona researching a food guide to Barcelona was certainly, you know, pretty amazing and an opportunity I would never have had otherwise. Same with the other books. You know, we're with Richard Cornish, who's co-author, and I spent a month researching two different books in Spain, Rustica and Solera, which is the south of Spain. So traveling, meeting amazing people, eating incredible food, you know, stealing their recipes and then readjusting them in Australia was, you know, things like that. Just experiences more than anything else. As Mavita's been able to give those to me, which, you know, and through probably any other career wouldn't have been accessible to me. So, and also, like, my best friends, people I hang out with are people that I have met through Mavita, whether they be business partners, whether they be staff, whether they be customers. It's kind of what my world revolves around. So, you know, that's important. You know, my kids are a little bit young yet to work in the business, but I'm sure they will eventually, you know, and it becomes a bigger part of life in general.
It's been a pretty life-changing year for most people, and particularly those in the hospitality sector. How have you felt personally during this time? Has it changed you?
Well, to be honest, like I've probably haven't worked this hard for a good 10 years, I reckon. Like I'm, you know, well into my 50s now. I'm just sitting down outside. I've been in the kitchen all day. Feet hurt. You know, but it makes me feel better. To be honest, as far as like doing that, it makes me feel like I'm doing what I do well, you know, because as being, you know, trained as a chef, being in the kitchen is what you understand and know. So I feel like happier about that than being a little bit distant from it and managing a business, which is important, obviously. But, you know, like it's brought the priorities and everything into a bit more focus and what's important and, you know, and the staff and, you know, and dealing with, you know, their frustrations, but sort of also bringing them along and trying to get them in, yeah, and they're all been amazing, but trying to get them, you know, buying into what we're trying to do, which is basically come out of this, you know, when we reopen and then continue on. So, yeah, it's been a bit more a sense of camaraderie and a feeling that probably I haven't had for the last 10 years working in the industry, in La Vida. Yeah, because you sort of separate after a while, right? Like, you know, you're not in the kitchen every day anymore, so you don't have the same connection to all the chefs that I did, you know, 10 years ago, but all of a sudden that's changed now. So I feel, you know, it's like invigorated me as a cook, but also as a manager as well.
Well, you do have the date set that restaurants can open their doors to guests again, and it's pushing into summer at that time as well, and hopefully the restrictions will ease further. How's it going to feel for you when you welcome guests back into the restaurant for the first time?
Oh, it's going to be a massive relief. I mean, we've had that experience already once. It feels, it's just a weight off, and it feels like, you know, we've been dealing with customers, but through this sort of, you know, virtual way of delivering the food for a logistics company or through our front of house staff, but to seeing actual customers in front of you. I remember that, when we reopened the first time, it's, you know, just lots of different stories, lots of, you know, how grateful customers are to be back into a restaurant situation and enjoying themselves. And it really makes you understand how vital sort of the restaurants and hospitality in general are for, you know, the common good, I've got to say, like, not just for restaurateurs, but for the whole society. Like, people really, you know, love their favorite little places, whether it's a pub, whether it's a cafe, or whether it's a restaurant. And it's, you know, intrinsic in their way of life. And you know, when you see people come back, especially regulars, massive smiles on their faces. And there's connections there as well, you know, with all the staff, myself, people that have been coming for years that have the same table. I'm at Movida Key. There's one customer that has a plaque here for 550 visits. So we're looking forward to welcoming him back as well. Amazing. I mean, apart from, you know, obviously it's progression in keeping the business going, but it's also like a lot of people you haven't seen and you miss, and the feeling of doing what you do and looking after customers, you know, making something. Like, for me, I was talking before about how, you know, my background was studying architecture, and the whole process with architecture is it may take a year or two before you see any feedback or recognition of a project you might do. With cooking, for me, the beauty of it is that, you know, you could get a product in that morning, you've designed it, you've produced it, you've created it, and you've sold it, and you've got the feedback all within, you know, a day, maybe within 8 hours. And it's a pretty cool feeling, right? So this is that whole creative process, you know, it feeds a lot of chefs, and that feedback is really important to it. So, it'll bring back a lot of positivity back into all the chefs.
Well, Frank, it's only a week and a bit away, actually, before you can swing the doors open again. It's not long. So good luck. We really loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today. Please keep in touch, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we share the stories of Australia's hospo community, suppliers and producers in search of hope during this pandemic. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.